If you look for it, every day has cause for celebration. Celebrate a friend for their promotion, baby wedding, life thing. Celebrate yourself for keeping the couch warm. It's no easy feat, especially if it's a big couch. Or maybe you just want to celebrate living in 2023, where you can get beer, wine, and spirits delivered from Drizly in under 60 minutes without leaving said couch. So download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's drizly.com and get your favorite drinks delivered today.
Hi, I'm Dave Hillis, producer, mixer, engineer, and you're listening to Whatever, Never Mind.
I would like to welcome to the program Dave Hillis. There's zero chance I mispronounced the name, correct?
Yeah, it's a pretty easy one.
Right on. Now, should I call you an engineer, a producer, a musician? What kind of title would you like?
I'm those three things.
all of the above.
Yes. I'm all those three things.
All right. Well, give us a little background on you. I know you, reading your bio on your page, you started out as a musician in the band Mace, a thrash metal band, actually. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. We guitar player, in my teen years there, fell in love with heavy metal stuff and then British New Wave of heavy metal, and then got influenced by a lot of punk rock stuff as well. And that kind of was, at the time, started, we were one of the first bands there was like kind of blending those two styles together, which kind of came known as thrash, or was popular down in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we started taking trips to and playing down there. And so we were around that same time as Metallica and Death Angel and Testament and that whole Bay Area Exodus. And we kind of did that thing. So it morphed into your basic, heavy metal kid into that more specified kind of thrash scene there.
Now, you said you would
go ahead. Oh, I was just saying, we got on a couple compilations at first. We got on Metal Massacre 5, which was kind of, a breaking ground for a lot of those types of bands on Metal Blade Records. And then on a Northwest compilation called Northwest Metal Fest. And that got the ball rolling. And then we were able to do two full-length records on some independent labels in here in the States and in Europe. So, and we're in all the fanzines. And so that was my first taste of really doing it professionally. But throughout that time, though, I was interested in recording, and I started writing and doing demos wasn't good at learning songs, so I started writing right away. I just didn't have the patience to learn stuff, so I started writing. So I was demoing things like right away. 14, 15 years old, I was saving money and getting into these little studios, and nice. Worked at a record store, and that's where my money went.
I'm sorry, where were you based out of around this time? You said you went to San Francisco for that scene. We were
Seattle. My family we're from Brooklyn, New York originally, but my father got work in the Seattle area, so we were like a suburb of Seattle.
You toured with any of these bands from that time? Any of the big four?
Yeah, we did. It was so DIY. So it was basically you would set up tours by being, you'd be in these fanzines and playlists, and you would make friends and write to, before email, of course, to other bands, and you would set up tours that way. And that's really how we did it. But yeah, and then we kind of had different managers and things. And for a while, we got bigger opportunities. Like we got to do a number of shows with Slayer and then Raven and Anthrax and things like that. So we started like, you know, getting those opening spots that were pretty cool. Mostly on the West Coast and Southwest kind of.
Were you part of like, are personally involved in that the whole tape trading scene that was kind of,
absolutely.
Very key to that scene.
Yes, that was what it was all about, really, was the tape trading. That's how you got known and got another playlist, as it were, not Spotify playlist, but playlist that these fanzines and the different writers from the fanzines would have every month in the beginning of the fanzine. There'd be each guy's playlist, and that's kind of what spread word about you. And then there'd be tape trading and demo tapes, live tapes, whatever.
Was Slayer the only one of the big four you actually did shows with?
Let's see. Well, who's the big four?
Metallica, Megadeth, and Anthrax.
So Anthrax we played with, Slayer we played with. Megadeth and the Metallica guys would be at our shows. We never did end up playing with any of those guys. But we hung with them. They were at our shows and, you know, that kind of thing. But a lot of punk rock bands too, like DRI, Corrosion of Conformity, Circle Jerks. We did a lot. That was right when things were crossing over. We were friends with this band called The Accused, who were kind of doing it coming from the other side, being in a punk band, turning kind of metal tendencies to it, and us going that way. And we kind of influenced each other. And that, you know, that was kind of a legendary time scene, at least that was going on.
How does that segue into you becoming kind of an engineer, producer, that kind of deal?
Well, so like I said, I was early on doing demos and things like that. As I was getting, you know, older, a little more savvy at it, and realizing that the production was just horrible on our records, you know, I wanted.
No band has ever felt that way before, by the way, just you.
And I was pretty determined, you know, to be successful in the music business. I was, you know, all I thought about that was, you know, that was the only plan. I wanted to have more control of my recording situation and things like that. And with having, you know, four tracks and stuff at home, I felt like I was getting better and new things. And, so after that band had broken up, I was jumping around many different styles. You know, I was never one of the guys to just stick to one thing. I was like, I was jumping around from different styles, everything from, you know, industrial music and goth music to, you know, Brit pop to whatever. I was just trying everything. I just kind of liked music, and I was trying to find my thing. As were a lot of bands in Seattle at that time, were kind of fusing things together and playing musical chairs and bands just kind of doing that thing. I was recording, you know, once again, just always in the studio. And how I actually made the real jump was I went and had a band that I had. I realized the studio that was the most, like, you know, world class, as it were, was London Bridge Studios in Seattle. And I wanted to get in there. So I did a demo there. And during that time, I did a demo there. And Rick Parasher, who I ended up working for later on, was there, but he was giving a guy named Don Gilmore a shot because Don was kind of interning under him. And Don went on to do like Linkin Park and all kinds of things, but this was like his first alone gig, and it was happened to be with me doing this demo of some guys I put together. I was trying to put a band together, and after he'd done that, I ran into Rick at a club, famous club in Seattle called the Vogue, and he had just said, "Oh, hey, weren't you in the studio? I saw you in there." And I said, "Yeah, how'd it go?" And I said, "Great." And we ended up talking, hanging out, and he invited me back to the studio for a party. He said, "Hey, can you know those girls over there? If you bring them, you can go back to the studio." So I was like, "I'm in," because I just wanted to get to the studio because I was all about that. And from there, he mentioned that he was looking for, you know, a new assistant and things like that. And I just got his number and harassed him like until I could get in there and an interview with him. And that's how, that was my big jump. And then like my first day there was like while he was mixing Temple of Dog.
I'd already
been in there now many times, and I knew many bands that were already in there, so I was familiar with the place, and I knew it would be a good score to get a gig working there. So, you know, because Labone had already done Apple there, Alice had already recorded there, and these were all friends of mine from, you know, we all were, you know, shared the same rehearsal rooms, ran around the same parties, you know, all, you know, had played in each other, different bands or different versions of bands, or, you know, sold gear to each other or something, you know what I mean? We were all pretty incestual scene. So, you know, I was calculating enough to know that that was probably a good move for me.
You know,
to get in on.
As someone like, you know, I mean, when I was younger, I was in bands and we did that kind of stuff. The scene here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the Twin Cities, it was not as communal as Seattle always seemed. And if you really break down the stories of like that LA Sunset Strip thing, there really wasn't a lot of like helping each other out or just, you know, being friends and actually like wanting success for someone other than yourself. But Seattle seemed a little different in that way. Is that a fair generalization from someone who wasn't there?
Close. I'd say there was a communal thing, although it could be very clicky too.
Okay.
And there was definitely a difference between suburbs and city. So, you know, like the...
And which were you again? Were you a kid from the burbs?
I was so city oriented that I was from the burbs, but I never was there. I knew that the smart thing to do was be in the city, so I kind of played both sides as it were.
I gotcha.
Like I said, I had early ambitions, so I was pretty sly about all that kind of stuff. But that being said, that like the guys like in there's just kind of more, you know, your the scene with like with the Pearl Jam guys coming from Green River and you know, and Mark Arm and all that, that was kind of, you know, a lot of the city. But then, you know, there's different things too, like Nirvana. I mean, Kurt came out of Aberdeen from wherever. Yeah. So as things started rolling there, you know, anybody could do whatever. Even Alice in Chains were people from the suburbs, but yet they kind of got in that group. But like I say, there was just little clicks at times. But
okay,
I was able to kind of keep my foot in most of them. So
being
an opportunist that I am.
Well, with that, back to your kind of like studio thing. So your education really came hands-on, just kind of getting your foot in the door, and that's how you learned basically.
It was, yeah, I mean, like I had to be, I spent a lot of time, quite a lot of time to see for my age at that point. So, you know, I kind of learned basic, you know, stuff as it were, but you know, working on like a Neve console, obviously I'd never had a chance in that mm-hmm. type of thing. So when I got there, so the real first project that, you know, he was doing Temple of Dog and I was kind of learning and he was giving me time to learn, was a band called Love on Ice that was out of Portland, and they had signed to Interscope, which was a new label at the time. And, you know, it was a big deal actually, money wise and stuff. And I was pretty much just thrown in the fire. Like there was no manual or anything. And he didn't really like, Rick wouldn't really teach me necessarily. And especially now I look back on it, I'm thinking, wow, you know, he could have told me something.
Hey, what a dick.
He really can... Yeah. Well, that could be
you know
bad.
What I mean? I'm just joking.
But he just threw me into it. And, you know, he knew that I had certain, you know, he knew I knew a lot, you know, I knew guitars, I knew guitar pedals, I knew, you know, he knew some strengths, and he wasn't necessarily a rock guy per se. So, like moving along into like Pearl Jam, that came like there, he knew how to utilize me as well too. Like, me knowing the guys in the band, and like working with Mike and stuff, helping him get guitar sounds and speak their language, was a good thing, because Rick, that's not really the side, that's not really how Rick worked. And so, you know, being there running the tape machine while doing solos or punching in parts was a little bit less intimidating probably with me doing it than Rick, you know, at times. And so that kind of worked out good, and that's kind of what became our way. But as far as like, you know, technique and actual gear, it was kind of just, here's how it goes, and you better keep up and watch and do. And he was, and so, you know, that was kind of cool. I was like hands on right from the start. So that, you know, what I really learned from him a lot was his side of producing, in the sense of, you know, he's a real stickler for like pre-production and arrangements and arranging harmonies and writing the harmonies, you know, how tight, you know, the actual takes were, being particular about things, you know, the details and things like that, where that's where a lot of schooling came in from him. But I still, you know, it's my toolbox now.
And you know what, on a side tangent, just, did London Bridge become Bad Animals, or is that, do I have that wrong?
Yeah, that's wrong. So Bad Animals was a studio called Steve Lawson's, back in the early days, and it changed names and hands a couple times.
Okay.
Bad Animals came for when that was downtown Seattle, right on Fifth Avenue, that kind of had its moments where it was doing a lot of commercial post work, and then but a lot of famous rock records, and then the Ann and Nancy Wilson from Heart bought it, and then the name Bad Animals came in, and then it was sold again. So it kind of had some different incarnations.
Is London Bridge still London Bridge, or is it still there working?
It is. It's London Bridge, and it was two of the guys who started working there right after me ended up conjuring me. Ended up buying it. They were able to buy it off the brothers, Rick and Raj.
Nice.
So it kind of stayed in the family. So, yeah. So they keep it at London Bridge, and they have, like, kind of become a bit of a museum, in a sense, landmark now, from all the grunge stuff, as it were.
No, you said Rick's last name earlier.
Parasher.
Parasher? Okay, I was just saying Parasher prior to this, but...
Parasher, I believe is how they say it.
Okay. Well, you worked with him for some time, right?
Yeah, I did. So we, it's kind of like that end of 89, 90, whatever that was. Up until, like, 2000 was really the end of it. There was a moment there where I actually got but on and off, I ended up getting a record deal myself with Island Records. And, that Rick produced. So we actually did that together as well. And then I kind of, you know, going on my own, and there would be different projects here and there that I'd come back to him with. But I was trying to break away for a while.
Well, let's get into the record at hand today, Pearl Jam 10, which you were the engineer working with Rick on. Do you have any insight as to how they ended up choosing Rick? Was it basically a proximity thing, or was there some, like, a little more like we want him kind of deal?
I think, well, a little bit of both, and it kind of made sense. You know, So, you know, Rick was obviously known and been doing work there, and they'd come in and done different things with him and realized, well, and it was also something that they had enough experience doing records that they, I think, Stone and Jeff really wanted to have a part of it. So it is, as it says, produced by Pearl Jam and Rick Parasha. So I think they knew they needed somebody to help them, but they wanted to have some kind of more input and control at that point. And so I was thinking was that Rick was, you know, a pretty exceptional engineer, And I know, like, you know, with working with Dave Jordan and other people, because of coming into London Bridge, everybody was, you know, pretty impressed with Rick as in his own engineering skills. And I think it just made sense. Like, wow, we could do this great studio with the classic Neve and Studer and Rick. And, you know, it made sense. And we ended up doing two demos, like month long, long time for a demo these days, with the guys too. So like the, you know, Stonehead had done writing demos already, and the whole free even Pearl Jam at all.
Sure.
And then Jeff kind of got, I think helped, or I don't know if he played on those or not. Jeff got in a band with a band called War Babies that was on Columbia for a minute there. And Mike Goldstone, who was the A&R from Epic, who was signing them, you know, had also worked with the Mother Love Bone too. And I think he just believed in Stone and Jeff. He knew that he just believed in them. So he was kind of financing the demos for Stone. And when it looked like, okay, this is going to be a band, he gave more demo money for them to come into London Bridge. And that's when, you know, Eddie was basically his real tryout. And so,
just back up a little bit there. Jeff was financing the demos at the time?
No. Goldstone, the A&R.
Oh, right. Okay, I'm sorry.
Michael Goldstone.
I'm glad I cleared it up.
No, yeah. You know, giving them demo money to write and whatnot. So I think the deal was, like, I don't even know if they were officially signed until, I mean, we were already kind of in the studio. Mm-hmm. But I don't really know all the details from that.
Right.
But anyway, we did those and you know, so yeah, it made sense. I think it just, that was just, you know, instead of going off, I think with some, big producers, the label would want them to do or whatever, they wanted to be somewhere more comfortable and have, you know, their control over it.
You mentioned that you were brought in kind of while they were mixing Temple of the Dog. Did you know these guys well prior to working on this record?
Yeah. Well, I didn't know Chris. I knew, you know, I knew Stone the best, probably, Mike.
I'm talking Pearl Jam, Pearl Jam, basically. Once 10 starts, did you know those guys at all?
Yeah. I knew all of them pretty much. Dave Cruz, I didn't know actually at all, the drummer. Although it's funny is that now I talk to him all the time. Mike, I knew from rehearsal rooms and God, I think we should, you know, loan the amps to each other, you know, stuff like that. Stone, I definitely knew. We were like, you know, kind of friends around town all the time. And Jeff, and just from the different bands, and so yeah.
No,
so it was kind of weird when they were in there doing that. I was like, kind of like, man, you know,
hey guys,
and I was kind of bummed I wasn't doing my own record. I was like, gosh,
yeah,
these guys are doing a record. So
it is kind of amazing coming off of Mother Love Bone that they just kind of like landed in. First of all, they were able to kind of plow through that and forge ahead. And then also just basically end up with another record deal. I mean, that's something to be said there, man. Somebody believed in them.
Yeah, definitely. People believed in them. And, you know, it helped too. They had, you know, they were lucky they had management then too. I mean, that was big, I think a big deal in that whole group of people and scene happening is that, you know, they had Susan and Kelly Curtis and people like that around that were forming management that had some, well, with Kelly Curtis, he had some success off of and knowledge from experience from Heart in those right. days. And so at least there was some kind of liaison into the major label world for them that might not have been as easy if that wasn't true, you know?
Of course. Yeah.
And to protect them too, to guide them, you know.
Yeah, and that's the other thing too, is like have someone that actually wants the best for you. I guess is that's not always the case in this industry, but
right.
Is it true?
Yeah,
that...
I was very familiar with all of them and knew the story and the whole bit, and I knew Andy as well. And
yeah, I was going to ask you. So, how well did you know Andy?
fairly well. Good enough to, you know, say, hey, Andy, you see him being at shows together. We went to a Wasp show together.
what year-ish?
Oh, God, I don't know. What year would that have been? When was Wasp? I don't know.
Well, their debut came out and see you're that's funny that I'm just gonna rattle this off. Their debut came out in 84. So then they I don't know, like 84 to like 89
they were kind of bigger at that point, so it might have been maybe 5 inch. They were probably 86 maybe. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah.
I remember though.
Last Command. What was their third record called? Inside the Electric Circus, and then it was Headless Children. I don't know if any of that helps. I'm just saying those are the
four. I don't know. I can't remember. I remember his walk, and I remember him. Here's why this is imprinted in my mind. He stole, grabbed a bunch of T-shirts from the merchandise. People that weren't looking got a whole armful, and we were out there, and he was, back at that time, there was a so the radio station was KISW, it was a big rock station in Seattle, and they would get those guest station ID things. And one of them was Kevin DeBrow that was playing all the time from Quiet Riot. And so Andy was imitating Kevin DeBrow, a voice that you hear all the time on this ad that was going on, selling Wasp T-shirts. And that his shtick was walking around, this is Kevin DeBrow. I can't do a Kevin DeBrow imitation, but
that wasn't bad.
It was just freaking hilarious since we were there. And that's what's imprinted in my mind from doing that. And as everything he did big.
Yeah. Have you seen the, not to get too deep into it, cause we're not talking about it, but have you seen that documentary on him? I think it's called Malfunction or something like that.
Yeah, I saw that, a while back. It's been a while, but I saw that, like, I think when they first kind of did it, and then they played it in a small theater thing in up in Capitol Hill in Seattle. But yeah,
you know, let me ask you something just on that alone, because there is a version of that on YouTube now where it's clear that whoever, like, someone took the I don't know if it's the people who made it or somebody else, but they reposted it, and every time they talk to anybody from Pearl Jam, they put some kind of disparaging kind of thing under there. What is, I just don't know the beef. Was there a problem between the Wood family and the surviving guys? Cause it sounds like the father was willing to, like, you guys should pursue your dreams. Do you know anything about that at all?
Not really. I don't. I remember what would you call it? Memorial.
Yeah.
At where was it? Moore Theater or somewhere like that.
Yep.
And that had some kind. It had a very ominous kind of dark vibe to it. Yeah. You know, I don't know. It was just a weird time. You know, but I don't know any of the like internal.
Okay.
Things about that. No.
Fair enough. Let's get into 10. One of the things I came across was that the track Alive is actually, as far as the bass recording track, that's the original demo. Is that accurate?
From what I know or remember, once it starts going to the labels, who knows what, it's hard to know what was what. I thought there was a different version that was from the video.
No, yeah, the video I thought was a live recording they actually kept.
The record, as far as I know, is the one we recorded there.
Okay.
I don't remember that.
Well, there's all sorts of articles on this record, so you don't know how legit some of the stuff. The story was they just couldn't recapture the vibe of that track. And so they went with kind of the bass tracks of the demo that they did with yourself and Rick.
But you would think I would know because I was the guy editing.
Well, exactly,
all
man.
The reels. I don't think so. I don't think. You know, I can't quote 100%, but I don't believe that's true.
All right. I'll take your word for it.
And the reason why I'm saying too is because when we're tracking, and like no other record I've ever worked on since. The whole thing that made that record special and different is that, and you probably couldn't do it today just because of budgets and things, is that, and just the advent of Pro Tools, but it's that they were very much they wanted to get things live in a take as a band.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent so much time, and the amount of tape that was used, most people's budget today, you know, for a record wouldn't even meet their tape budget, was immense. Like, we had so much tape that there was a window from the control room out to the lobby, to the lounge, and you couldn't see through it because it was just stacked out high full of 2-inch tapes. And I remember just the amount of time we spent going through takes of the different reels for the different songs we wanted. Just the listening back of all those, you can record a record, you know what I mean? Because there's so much material to go back over and pick which was the best takes and notes that we'd have. So most of it, we spent so much time that I don't think we would have went back to a demo on that. But
okay.
So it could be wrong. But then even the... And they were meticulous. I mean, we could punch in places. We could, you know, these days you just edit everything together in Pro Tools.
Right.
But there might have been, you know, some songs where we said, well, you know, God, that outro or that bridge in this song or this take was just great. We might have edited that part and put it into another whole reel, but that would have been about it. They really wanted to get a whole live tape. And nobody would have really known, you know, but that was like a big deal for them.
What, were there any songs in particular that were extremely kind of tedious as far as hard to get what they wanted?
Well, yeah, there's kind of a story already out there about Even Flow. We did. So Even Flow, we're doing these day after day of just all day tracking. And,
okay.
Extremely hard working band. I mean, there was no partying, no downtime. It was just show up and work, record, work. And so because I was going so long, there'd be times where Rick would go, you know, say, all right, just keep recording. And, you know, so I'd be there, you know, he'd leave. We'd go into the night because we'd go into the night and he's not going to sit there and listen to the same song, you know. It's just, so my job was to record it and, you know, put stars or notes next to ones I thought were pretty good. And then in the morning we'd go through and maybe comp something or listen to whatever, so that if there was a good take, you know, we'd move on and start overdubs or whatever. And Even Flow was just going all day, all night, into the night. And it's getting late now. I don't remember.
Was there a problem or was it just like,
not a problem. They just didn't think they had that magic take. It was all about getting that magic take. Just the perfect feel, perfect groove. Just that was what it was all about. And I mean, you can tell the record has that, you know, everything has such a great feel and groove to it.
Yeah.
I know that one was just eluding them, and they just kept trying it. And, like I said, I told this is kind of, so this is a pretty funny one on me. So we're like, I don't know, it's gotta be 2 a.m. or something. And, I'm sitting there and it's just, you know, we get done end of the song and I'd be like, you know, all right, is that it? And they're like, no, say it again. So all of a sudden this take's going and I'm sitting in the control room by myself, feet up or whatever, doesn't even go into it. And I hear this, and that's the sound of the tape running off the reels.
That was a great impersonation of that, by the way.
Thank you. I've heard it enough times.
Yeah.
And I thought there was enough tape on the reel and there wasn't. So I'm thinking, well, no big, because I go first. I'm like, oh my God. And they're going to do it again anyway, right? I mean, it's been all day. That couldn't be the one. So I go over there, and you know, the song ends and I hear them from the control room going, yeah, that's it. And I'm like, oh my God. And I'm feeling the reel back on and panicking, going, it can't be, it just can't be. And I come in, hey man, that was good. Can we hear that back? And they're like, yeah, just give me a minute. Let me get your rough mix phone. Just call you in a second. So I quickly spliced an ending from another reel that was sitting next to me, hoping that they wouldn't notice. And that's what I did. So then they came and played it back. And if you know anything about editing tapes, you'll hear it when it goes past the heads on the tape machine. It'll go, and you'll hear it. So I just made sure I had it cranked. And I stood over in front of the tape machine so nobody could see an edit splice go by. And nobody noticed. And it was funny because I read another interview, or I did an interview with Mix Magazine, and then apparently that author had read a interview that Mike McCready was doing, and he had talked about how that song was the one they spent all day on. It was like they wanted to kill each other. So it kind of documented that whole day.
Okay.
That's the original question.
Being that this was his first kind of like, I know he was on Temple of Dog for a little bit there for the Hunger Strike thing, but this is really Eddie Vedder's real first big time experience in a studio, and singing, you know, in a recording studio is terribly different, I don't have to tell you, than singing live. Was he a quick study? Was there a lot of coaching? What was he like to work with basically on his first, you know, real big time record?
Well, it's really good question, really interesting story actually. So it wasn't magic right away. It took a bit. I know he was, you know, a lot of people don't realize, but it was a big deal at the time in Seattle for him to be taking, in a way, Andy Wood's place.
Cause right.
In Seattle, Andy was like a legend. And so it was kind of a big footsteps to walk into. And they were kind of reinventing themselves too as well. The band and Eddie was new, not part, you know, so there was a lot of that going on. I know that's why they were really kind of having him hang out with Chris and become friends with Chris to get confidence. There's a lot of that going on from Chris, not in the studio, but I know outside of the studio, that was a big part of things. It took some time, and I always think about it as like, he wasn't really Eddie Vedder that we know yet. Like the Eddie Vedder I met was, you know, he was a lot different. He was, you know, like the first day I saw him that I opened the studio door for him. He showed up first was this, I'm waiting outside kind of early morning and this lowrider yellow, bright yellow tinted window, like Chevy Love pickup. Comes roaring into the parking lot like crazy speed. I'm like, what the hell? And he gets out and stuff, and he's a totally nice guy. But the point is, you don't see tinted window, yellow low-riding Chevy Loves and wet, rainy, cloudy.
Forgot that car, that vehicle existed until just now. I know what it looks like. Yeah.
So that was kind of like, whoa. You know, that's not a Seattle dude. And anyway, but, you know, he was kind of discovering this character to be born in a way. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really until, so there was some, I remember in particular was a moment when the band and Rick were in the control room and having kind of a discussion, a meeting where I'm not really involved in it, but I'm there hearing it while I'm doing whatever I was doing. And it was like there was some concern whether Eddie could do this or pull it together. I didn't notice anything in particular that was bad going on or anything, but I remember the discussion. And so what it ended up happening is we had a lot of basic tracks done and stuff when we vet. We showed Eddie how to, we'd keep three or four tracks open and show him on the remote to the tape machine on how to arm and record himself and switch to another tape, And we'd lock him in the studio. So he went to this, this local video tape, you know, movie rental place, and he'd rent all these like crazy documentaries and weird movies. I remember William Burroughs movie or interview movies and things like that were a big one for him. And he was playing those, and maybe have wine or something. Not really that much. And he was writing lyrics and singing and, in the control room with the mic on a stand, sitting in the control room, arming the tracks. And I would like get him all set. Okay. After we were done doing our things, I'd say, all right, I'm leaving and I'm going to lock you in. And so I'd lock him up and, he would work all night and over that period of time, he kind of developed the Eddie Vedder that we know, like through the lyrics and his stylings and, you know, his vocal stylings and cadences and things. And that's really where it kind of seemed to become Eddie Vedder all of a sudden. And then it was like where we were getting good takes. Rick would listen, comp him in the morning, like meaning putting some different versions together, and then they'd either punch through it or he would try to recreate them as a whole. And then we really started getting on a roll.
So he did actually need just a little bit of time to get used to putting on the headphones and singing versus, you know, screaming into a microphone with stage monitors.
And you got to think of it this way too. They weren't like a band that had a chance to form and write a bunch of songs in the rehearsal rooms and play the clubs and stuff. And like over 3 years, all right, we're ready to do a record. It wasn't like that. They were like becoming and developing this new band and sound and style and group energy and all that together pretty much in the studio. I mean, for outside of the rehearsal room that they had gotten and when Eddie would come up, but it wasn't like they were like in a band together for a long time and had this growth period to become Pearl Jam. It was kind of happening in real time.
Man, when you say it like that, this is even more amazing how big this record ended up becoming. But I hadn't even thought about that because I was always focused on coming off the Mother Love Bone deal, you know?
Right. And, you know, putting the lyrics together, I think, and then as the lyrics come together, that puts imagery in your brain and that imagery kind of flows to the other guy. You know, it was all like unfolding, like while they were doing it. So and in a lot of ways, that's why there wasn't really a necessary like image or anything came from that band, because it was just kind of happening. And they were so all just about the music and the writing that I think that's another reason why it's so authentic, you know, in many ways.
And Yellow Ledbetter was recorded during these sessions, correct?
Yeah.
Do you understand a single word he says in that song?
Oh, man, I remember. I think back now, like, I used to have all the lyrics, you know, of him writing all over the console because for punching in and whatnot, so I could know where to come in and come out, or if I was comping tapes or whatever. But man, I should have probably saved this. But you know, yeah, it was like honestly, my opinion at the time was I didn't know what the hell he was. I hadn't heard that style of singing. I didn't know what they were doing. I didn't really get the direction. I thought it was kind of,
well, it sounds a little bit like Little Wing from Jimi Hendrix when it opens up, but
The whole thing seemed very classic rock to me.
Yeah, like, there we go.
Which was not very popular, or not what I was thinking of at the time or attracted to at that moment. And I'm like, well, you know, I really didn't get where they were going with all this. And I mean, honestly, to be sell myself out here and be short-sighted, I was like, well, you know, I'm glad the guys at least had some success with getting a deal with Love Bone and everything, because I don't know what this is going to do. So that's why I guess I was never an A&R guy at that time, because I didn't, you know, I honestly did not, I didn't see it doing anything. I didn't really get it.
If it makes you feel better, this was an album that it took me a while to actually understand myself. Once it clicked, it was like, fuck, this is amazing.
Yeah, I know. Even being so close to it, I just, you know, I didn't get. But, you know, also being so close to it, too, and where I was coming from, I was so about doing a good job engineering-wise and getting good, clean, great classic sounds, not because I wanted them to have classic records, you know. It was because of my own selfish...
you wanted to do a good job and be known as the guy who did this, right?
Well, I just was really trying to keep Rick off my ass and get good at what I was doing, you know, so that one day when I make a record or whatever, you know, that's how we were all thinking back then, you know. And that's the thing that was cool about that scene, is that all of us, everybody around there, was incredibly ambitious, and not in a undercutting way, like, if that goes back to what you were asking earlier about people helping each other, but everybody really had some serious goals and were serious about it. Where maybe in LA they were getting a little too caught up in imagery and the partying and the fun, even though, you know, the drugs got known from Seattle. But I tell you, work situations in the studio were serious. Like my work with Alice in Chains, all that. There was never like shenanigans or partying. It was all down to business when you're in the studio.
Well, let me ask you this. Were you offended then when they had Brendan O'Brien come in and basically just strip it all down and redo it?
Well, I was curious. Well, I kind of saw it coming, because that's two part answer for me. Like, I really like Tim Palmer and what Tim Palmer did for the mixes.
Yeah.
I feel like if he wouldn't have mixed that record, I don't know if it would have been as big as it would have been at that time. I think how he mixed it is what made it do so well at radio for that particular moment in time. And, so in that sense, but I also knew that Jeff wasn't happy with the amount of wetness, as he would say. He just felt there's too many reverbs and things like that on it, and too roomy. And I know Eddie felt the same way, and Ed was getting more and more into, like, you know, kind of the punk side of things, and really like Fugazi and less production and things like that, which is always easy to say after you get to that point. So I kind of saw that they had that regret, and saw that that's where the new albums were going to go. And I think they just always in the back of their mind wanted to see what Chen would have sounded like that way.
Okay.
So I wasn't too shocked or anything by them doing that. But I think it speaks for itself. You know, the record is one of the biggest records out. You know, I mean,
yeah. Went on to sell 13 million copies.
Yeah.
No, have you heard the Brendan O'Brien deal?
I have, and just not that long ago, really. I just wasn't really interested, to tell you the truth, hearing it. I finally heard it because I was doing a talk at a audio, you know, thing where people, what do you call it, panel type thing, workshop, and and that record was the theme of it, 10, and they started playing Brendan's mix while I was sitting there. And I hadn't listened to the record in a long time in the first place. But they didn't say that it was Brendan's. And I was listening to it going, man, this sounds different to me. Like, tripping out. Like, I do not remember that being like that or this or that. And then, you know, comes to find out it was Brendan O'Brien's mix, and I'm like, oh my god, I thought I was going crazy. Or I thought they just sounded completely different than what I remembered or something. But so I've heard it since that way.
Do you like it?
I can't say. I mean, Brendan's amazing.
Yeah.
So you can't really knock it. I'm probably too close, like, you used to hearing it the old way, you know what I mean? So, you know, Well, I don't know.
I'll tell you this. I was never like someone who like this album needs to be remixed. I was fine with it the way
right.
it was.
It's not in the first one you would think that needs a remix.
Yeah. But when I first heard they did it, I was like, whatever. I've been hearing this remix remastered crap for the longest time. It ends up just being a little more bassy and a little louder. I don't care. I didn't realize this was actually a version where basically the knobs were all dialed to zero, all the effects were taken off, and they started over. When I finally did hear it.
I mean, like I said, I knew that Jeff and Eddie wanted that. I know Jeff
had
made that vocal quite a number of times.
But
after the record came out.
I do think it's very good. I like it better. But again, I never had a problem with it to begin with. So it's like, it kind of, I don't know. Like, I'm not someone who was there in the studio, though. I might be a little different if I was feeling it that way. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair point for Jeff and Eddie to probably feel that way because, you know, being an artist myself and having records mixed is like, you know, and especially when you're on a label where you don't have as much say at the time or whatever.
Yeah.
And it probably sounded, well, they had say. They were there. They were there at the mixes and they liked it when they mixed it. But I think it just was one of those things that irked Jeff or Ed and to where they said, man, I just wonder what it would have been like if we would have went this way. And they had the power and the clout to be able to do that. I mean, I'm sure there's a ton of artists who would say, I wouldn't mind hearing this record redone, you know? Or what if, you know?
Sure. Well, let me ask you a little bit. Are there any kind of like fun or kind of laugh about it now kind of moments from recording this? Any anecdotes or stories you can share?
You know, I wish there were.
Well, you've like, shared a couple. Like I thought the story with Andrew
yeah,
was great.
That was kind of, you know, a funny one. Honestly, it was, you know, there's like you said, there was no shenanigans. It was all like them working on it. You know, Mike was always funny. Like, just being around him was funny. McCree was just a funny dude. And he was the newest to it and the most excited, I think, you know, about the whole process and nervous. You know, he showed his nerves. He would have these, his arsenal of beverages, we'd call it. So, like, when we'd be doing in the control room doing overdubs, he'd sit in the control room with his guitar feeding out to the live room with the amps. And he would have, we'd put it like a fold up table next to him and it would have like, you know, like start with a coffee, a Coke, a beer, a freaking lemonade. I don't know, like 30 different drinks on his table. And, you know, it just, he was so nervous and gung ho to do, you know, when you're making your first record like this and you're the guy who's hired to be the lead guitar guy, like, and he's always one of the, you know, that's his dream to be Mr. Guitar Hero. He was, you know, wanting to put down these legendary guitar solos. So it was fun. And, you know, always asking me, you think tone's right? You think this or that? I'm like, yeah, well, let's try this. And so it was fun when we got to work together.
What kind of guitar head did he use?
Well, it was cool because, I mean, it's kind of the way Pearl Jam is. There's never an overabundance of, like, they're not, like, crazy like that. They'll get, like, a few great classic things, meat and potato stuff. I mean, maybe Jeff with his, you know, multi-string basses there, the, you know, basses. That was, like, pretty decadent for them. But look what it produced. I mean, Jeremy wouldn't have been, you know, what it was and things like that. But it was basic stuff. Like, remember, we were excited to get, he got a real 59 Fender Basement. So that was pretty cool. Because it was a real vintage 59 Fender Basement. Other than that, I think we had my Marshall head, one of his Marshall, a red Marshall head that I remember him having in the rehearsal room days of other previous bands.
Which Marshalls?
JCM 800. Mine was 800. I think his was some, yeah, 80s thing. Cause it was those red ones that came out. And then nothing special. They are now. They were pretty stock then at that time.
Oh, right, yeah. The JCM 800 to me is the it's my favorite amp. Anyway.
Yeah. I still have that same amp. Bought it in high school. Still have it. But it was on that. So we had those. And I think there was some, like, Stone had gotten a Supro, like a Page One that he wanted. A couple other little amps. He had his Fender Twin that he always used. Stone did. Really neat, basic meat and potato stuff. Same nice. With, I mean, even less with Temple. Temple with Dog was like so after basics. But a little more things. I remember Stone got a brand new Gretsch. I remember that was cool. You know, little cool things, little cool gifts they got, you know, for being getting a new deal, but nothing overboard and real basic miking, you know, 57s, 421s, Neumann maybe, you know, an 87 maybe, and just basic pedals too that we just mix around and we just really, and, you know, lots of EQ with the knees and stuff, mm-hmm. but just going for real, just straight up good tones, and performance.
Well, how about this? When was the last time you actually sat down and listened to the record?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know because I don't, to be honest with you, I hardly listen to music at all because I'm always working on something.
Okay.
So whenever I'm in the car or somewhere, I'm like not, people make fun of me because like I have silence going, like when I'm working on shit or driving, like just put on there. You never listen to music. And I'm like, dude, I listen to music all day, every day. It's just somebody else.
Believe it or not, I know exactly what you're talking about. I listen to a lot of talk radio because of that.
I listen to a lot of talk radio. Yeah. But I don't, I haven't much, but then again, like if I do turn on the radio or something, or I'm in the car with somebody or with my wife, she loves this on a rock station. Boom, there's a Pearl Jam song. So it's like, you know, I hear one and it's cool. And actually, I enjoy that because it kind of makes, you know, I get a tinge of, oh man, you know, fucking worked on that one. You know, so yeah. It's kind of nice when I just hear it like there out in the open.
From a sales standpoint, would that be the biggest record you ever did? Or
yeah,
worked on?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's, the only Diamond Award I have, but you know, the Alice stuff and some other things came close. You know, nothing. Yeah, that, I mean, that's you know, hitting 10 million plus is pretty tough for anybody. I've been lucky enough to work with a lot of cool artists. So,
what about? Do you have any favorite tracks in this?
I always like Black and Porch was cool. I remember Black being stand out for me from the beginning, working on it. I remember, once again with the lyric sheets, I remember looking at the lyrics going, oh, that's, well, you know, and I always do this at least because I thought they weren't going to do well. Like, well, yeah, you know, he's a good lyricist. At least they got that. I'd always like kind of make excuses for them, which is hilarious being how good and successful they are. But, at the time, I was like, yeah. I think that one kind of always kind of stood out.
Yeah. I have a hard time because I think it's almost a perfect record. But Black is definitely one of the ones I would go back to. The ones that I don't.
Wash, I thought was good, too.
Which one?
I just remember that. Wash.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I love Release Me.
Really good too.
And yeah, but was there any like jokes about like we need to have at least one song with more than one word for a title?
No, I do remember that. I kept thinking, I kept thinking those were work titles. You know, I kept thinking those were working titles because yeah, everything was one word. I totally remember that.
Well, I think Why Go is the only two word. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I think if there were jokes, it was like me making jokes.
They're like, but, what a dick. Yeah.
But I, that's funny. I really always thought, oh, those must be work. Which would have made sense, right?
You know, no, of course. Like, yeah. You just kind of do things easy. And then you like when it, time comes down to it, you actually, you know, elaborate a little more, but
right.
Well, Rick died, I think, tragically young, of course. I think most people would say that in 2014 at the age of 50. Any memories of him you'd like to share? You know, anything related to this time or just in general?
Rick, he's one of a kind for sure. He had, you know, unique personality, especially amongst rock musicians. He's classically trained and all that. So he wasn't like, and he wasn't out to ever make anybody really like him necessarily, like with fans. Like he would say, you know, his job is to make a great record for you. That's, I'm not here to be your friend kind of thing. And I remember him and Stone, we would drive Stone home sometimes to the studio. Oh, the talks they would get into, and Stone would be like, just act like you like me. Kind of half sarcastically, but kind of true. And of course they did, but it was like, Rick was very, you know, he had, you know, he's East Indian and he had this way about him, and he didn't really change for anybody on that, but he was so meticulous and such a, you know, perfectionist, and, you know, with that, you know, incredibly talented musician. I mean, all those bands that worked with him, if it wasn't, you know, with his ability to play in those piano parts and showing and like really teaching everybody from Lane and Jerry to Eddie and how to really deliver their vocals and do harmonies, and he'd write with them on the harmonies and the piano, which a lot of people forget and don't know. All those great harmonies, those all came from Rick. Yeah. All that stuff was Rick and them sitting at the piano working those things out. He wouldn't let anything, you know, get by. Like, it was, he was going to make sure that song was the best that song could be. Hmm. So that, you know, he was impressive to work with. And I, like I said, I pull out of his toolbox all the time when I work.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, here's your chance to plug anything. What do you got going on? Do you want to talk about any projects you're working on?
I'm out in Pittsburgh now. I'm working on two studios out here. One called The Vault, which has a classic Neve console, and which I was excited about to find out here. And I actually have the, 2-inch machine, tape machine that I speak of in all these stories that we did Pearl Jam 10 on, and Temple of Dog and Alice in Chains and all those bands from London Bridge after Rick passed.
So you still record analog?
Well, I do as much as I can.
Okay.
I get into, of course, everything ends up in Pro Tools.
Right. But yeah.
So I was able to get the machine after when I moved out here. They were, so the studio stuff, I was talking with Rick's brother, Raj, and he was, you know, I asked him what's going on with the machine, and, you know, so I don't know. And I go, man, would you, you know, is there a way I could, would you sell it? And then they ended up letting, talking to his family and saying they'd like me to have it if I can, transport it. So I took it back out here and have it at the studio called The Vault and refurbished it. So that's an exciting thing, and people who come are pretty excited to get to work on that just for the history alone.
Yeah.
Not to mention the sound. So it's been kind of cool to keep a little bit of the history alive there. And then another studio out of here, Tonic, and I just built my own mix room, mixing and overdub room. So I've been rolling again and kind of having a nice career out here, working a little bit out of Nashville as well. Did a project called Ghost Hounds with engineer Vance Powell, who's pretty famous engineer producer, works with Jack White all the time. Just did a new band called Bitter Coast. I think it's going to do really well. Kind of based out of New York, and just doing my same thing. Just you know, just keep recording, finding new bands. Did a record of my own actually.
Really?
That's surprisingly, for most people, it's on the electronic side of things, lots of samplers and things like that.
It's not thrash.
But I do, because it's not thrash, and there's not even a guitar on it. But it's the type of stuff I could do to make doing rock music still interesting. You know, I like to do other things as well. So yeah, just keeping busy in music, and just grateful that I can, you know, just keep doing it.
No Mace reunion on the horizon.
Funny you should ask. I almost forgot. That is actually being reissued, from a Chinese label picked up. And just did a reissue of those, which was pretty funny to them having me hunt for old photos of different things that they wanted for, like, you know, doing like a booklet for it and all that. So that was interesting. But yeah, glad you asked me that. I almost forgot.
Right on. Dave, this was a lot of fun. You were amazing. Thank you so much for being part of this, man.
Oh, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All right. Have a good night, Dave.
All right. It's nice talking to you. What's the tagline for you?
It's just you're listening to Whatever Nevermind.
Whatever Nevermind, okay.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.